We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Our guest for this hour, our British writer Mark Stevenson, says that maybe a couple of years ago, he was thinking about the future and decided that maybe the only thing that he felt really certain about was that his future would play out in a world very different from the one that we have all grown up in. So he decided to set out on a journey. He traveled around the world, logged more than 60,000 miles. He visited four continents, and he talked with some very smart people to get some informed opinions about where it is that we humans are headed. He talked to people who are working on the human lifespan, who are working on improving the technology that we use all the time, people who are looking at some very big problems like how is it that we'll manage to feed the world in the future, and can we do something about big problems like climate change? And he says that he came away decidedly positive in the sense that if we apply ourselves and think carefully and make the right moves, that the future may not be such a bad place, at least not as bad as sometimes people imagine it to be. And he has put all of this down in a book that he's written that's just recently come out. And the title of his book is An Optimist's Tour of the Future. The subtitle is One Curious Man Sets Out to Answer the Question, What's Next? Avery is the publisher. Mark Stevenson is co-director of Flow Associates, that is Britain's most respected cultural learning consultancy, and also Re-Agency, which promotes science communication. He lives in London, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk about his book, certainly, you are welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so that means that if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. You may also send us an email if you'd like to do it like that, and the address is will-talk, so that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. And questions are welcome. We hope people can be brief, can be on topic. That way we can welcome in as many different people to the conversation. We'd like to get as many people as we can. But anybody is welcome to give us a call. And Mr. Stevenson, hello.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me on your show.
Good.
It's a great pleasure.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. And I guess as a way of starting out, if you look at over time, people who have engaged in this exercise, thinking about the future and what it would look like. Certainly there are optimists and there are pessimists, but it seems like the dystopias have a way of outweighing the utopias. And something I'm sure that perhaps you've thought about, why it is that it seems that most often when we think about the future, we don't see it as a wonderful, rosy place. We often see it as a very dark and troubling place. Mark? Well, speaking of technologies and how they often don't work well, I think we just lost the caller. We'll try that again, and we'll put through the call, and we'll get back with our guest, Mark Stevenson. I think he has an interesting book and has some interesting things to say. So I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll give you the telephone number again. You're in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the local number for people who are here where we are. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send us an email, if your phone's not working, but your radio is, you'd like to send us an email, you can do that very easily by writing to will-talk, that is W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. The book that we're talking about here is An Optimist's Tour of the Future, One Curious Man Sets Out to Answer What's Next, and it's published by Avery. And I think that we're getting the guest back up in line here. I'm not exactly optimistic about the future of the next hour. We'll have to see. We'll try again. Mark?
Hello, David.
I don't know what happened there. I'm sorry.
There you go. That's technology for you, right?
Isn't it the truth? That's what happens when you rely on technology. It's going to disappoint you. Okay.
Absolutely.
So I asked a question, and I don't know if you heard the question.
I got about half of it. Talking about why when we look at the future, we often think of it as a dystopian scary place.
Yes, indeed. Essentially so.
And just as I was about to answer that question, the technology cut me off, so maybe it doesn't like my answer.
I know. Someone's trying to prevent you from speaking the truth. Anyway, please go ahead.
Well, I think there's a number of really sensible reasons why we think about the future in a pessimistic way. The first is that it's completely unknown. You know, the past, we went there, we knew what happened. It generally worked out kind of okay because we're still here able to look back on it. I mean, it didn't work out great for some people, but for yourself, at least you survived. But when you look into the future, of course, it's completely unknown, and anything unknown is always looked at with some trepidation because, you know, it could go well, but equally well, you know, if we speculate, it could go badly. So I think there's a natural precautionary way of looking at the future, which we make ourselves sort of prepared for by sometimes imagining the worst. And you know, that's quite a sensible way of looking at the future in some ways. My dad always used to say to me, you know, plan for the worst and expect the best. But at least if you plan for the worst, you know, you won't be disappointed. And I think a lot of people adopt that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
So the other thing is that all the technologies that are coming to us are always new, and because they're new, we think about them similarly. I don't know if you remember, but for instance, when IVF was first proposed as an idea for helping infertile couples, there was a massive furore about this being, you know, the most terrible thing ever, that it would be dangerous, that it was man playing God. And we're naturally worried about these new technologies, again, because they're unknown, and we tend to be worried about what the implications will be. What tends to happen is when those technologies actually start working for our benefit, you see this 180-degree flip where people start doing the exact opposite. So it was that people were generally complaining about IVF until it started really working well and you had all these cute kids running around. And then you saw people writing to their congressmen saying, you know, demanding that they had access to it because, you know, they wanted that service. So it became an ethical flip the other way around. It became unethical not to offer it. So I think it really is just a natural trepidation about things that are unknown.
Mm. The other thing that I think it's interesting, instructive, sometimes amusing, is if you look back to what people in the past thought about as they thought about the future. You know, for example, it's easy to go back and look at what in the, you know, so the early 20th century, people were writing about the future and what they thought life would be like now, or maybe even go back to the 19th century. And we see that maybe in some basic respects, they had some sound ideas, but in many cases, it's laughable what it was that they thought it would be like. So I suppose that one thing that points to is that if you're imagining the future, you can imagine anything that you want. And in an exercise like the one that you have done, how it is that you try to keep it within some sort of reasonable limits.
Yeah, I think that's a really brilliant question. I mean, certainly if you look at the history of futurism, you'll learn an awful lot more about the times in which the predictions were made than you'll learn about the future. So, you know, a lot of the things that were imagined in the Cold War about the future reflected, you know, those ideas. I'm reading a novel at the moment from the 1960s, and it's set, you know, in 2200, and it's basically a Russia vs. America story, but set on the moon. So yeah, I think that's a very valid point. And I think it was Niels Bohr, the famous physicist, who said that making predictions is always difficult, especially about the future. So I, in my book, actually try not to make any predictions. It's not really a predictive book. What it does do is lay out the scientific horizon as it stands now. And because I think that the debates and choices we have from this point onwards are very important. There are some very interesting things happening in biotechnology and nanotechnology and information technology with the climate, with what's happening with the internet. And those can be directed in good ways or bad ways. And my feeling is that I wasn't getting a good enough of a picture from what I was reading in a way that could be understood by everybody. A lot of the books written about the topics I cover are written for people who are, I guess, are already interested in that kind of stuff. They read New Scientist, they read Scientific American. It's written from quite a technical, knowing perspective. And I wanted to cover something that was accurate, but also for the general reader, because I believe the more of us who are involved in those discussions, the more positively we'll direct our technologies in the future. Mm. Some people disagree with me. Some politicians would rather have that less of us were informed, but I believe that more of us should be, and that was one of the reasons for writing the book.
Mm. Well, maybe just before going on talking about what you really did do, maybe one more kind of general question. I think one of the things that's very striking if you go back again to, say, the the late 19th and early 20th century and how they thought about the future, is that there was this assumption that maybe people really didn't even think about it, but there seemed to be an assumption that people in the future would have access to unlimited energy. And that in the way people were living, there seemed to be very little thought given to resource consumption and waste production, things that are all three very real problems and real limitations. So, again, if you think about what people really are, the kind of research and work people really are doing now, is there enough thought given to what the implications would be of these various technologies if, in fact, we went forward with
them? I think, again, that's a really astute and brilliant question. I mean, one of the things I came to realize was we've never had an energy crisis. What we have is an energy conversion crisis. The sun is waving this massive energy paycheck in our face every single day, and we can't bank very much of it. And what we tend to do is when we're short of funds is we rush into the Mother Earth savings account, and the savings account is fossil fuels. It's energy that's been laid down for us, and we're using it because we haven't found an efficient way, a cost-efficient way to directly capture the sun's energy and turn it into stuff that we can use. And actually, you know, we do have limitless energy hitting the planet all the time. We just haven't been able to convert it. What I found very hopeful in some of my research was now we're getting to that stage in technology where we can start to bank a lot more of that energy paycheck a lot more efficiently and getting to the point where it's going to be cheaper than fossil fuels. And that's always been the problem before, is that fossil fuels, despite all their problems and their expense and whatever, and their massive inefficiencies, I found out, they've still been the most efficient and the cheapest way for us to get hold of the energy we need to grow our economies. And that's now reaching that cusp point. In Japan now, they reckon that solar power is just about to hit the point where it will be the same price as fossil fuels. And then you start to see a massive growth in the solar power industry. So in Japan, the solar power industry is growing at 110% a year. So we're just reaching that point. Also, with what's happening in biotech now, I went to see a number of firms who can take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, feed it through a bacteria, and that bacteria will turn it into gasoline. So again, that's starting to get cheaper and cheaper. So we're just at that cusp point now, and I don't make many predictions, but I would say that in the next 20 years, we will see an energy revolution because fossil fuels are only ever going to get more expensive, and these new technologies are only ever going to get cheaper, and we're just at that turning point now, and that I found very hopeful.
Our guest in this hour is Mark Stevenson. His book is An Optimist's Tour of the Future. One Curious Man Sets Out to Answer What's Next. Avery is the publisher. He is speaking to us from London. He's coordinator of Flow Associates. It's a cultural learning consultancy. He's also involved in something called Reagency that promotes science communication. He's also done some time as a stand-up comic and writer, and we're pleased to have him as our guest. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we'll talk some more about some of the people that you have talked with as you traveled around. I guess one thing that really does strike me about a lot of these people, and maybe if one is going to be a visionary, that you have to be like that. But that there are people who, when confronted with something that seems to be a barrier, whether it's the normal span of human life or whether it's the speed of light, things that are regarded to be as rules, things that you can't get around. All of these people are the kind of people, when confronted with that rule, they say, "Yeah, who says?"
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, maybe if you're going to come up with some remarkable new invention or way of being in the world, you have to be the one, kind of a person who comes up to what seems to be a rule and say, "Well, yeah, who says that's a rule?"
Yeah, that I think the thing that impressed me the most, I saw these amazing technologies and amazing ways of thinking as well. I mean, I didn't just look at high tech; I looked at agriculture and farming as well, and looked into ways that can be changed in very simple ways to improve economics and problems with the climate. But the thing I came away with at the end of the book that I was perhaps most impressed with was the people I'd met and exactly that attitude. And then two things: one, as you say, they kind of didn't really accept limitations on what was possible. I went to see a guy called Dick Rutan at the Mojave Spaceport, where the new commercial spaceflight industry is getting off the ground. And he said to me, "Never look at a limitation as anything you agree with. Only look at it as an opportunity for greatness." Mm-hmm. So, you know, in a way, these people sort of look at a limitation and go, that's it. That's my gold star. That's where I'm going to make my mark, because everybody else is accepting it, and I'm going to break it.
Well, this is the guy who set the record for flying around the world without stopping.
He did it on one tank of gas in a plane called Voyager. He's one of the world's greatest. 70 years old, the man, and you know, he's an absolute superhero.
But you sort of have to wonder his response to the idea that remember Einstein, the guy who said nothing goes faster than the speed of light. Well, his response was something we can't say on the radio.
Yes,
essentially, he said, baloney. He said, no, but that seems to be one of those things that is a generally accepted rule, or at least if you stretch your mind to the conditions that it would have to apply, that's a pretty big stretch.
Yeah, I mean, and Dick is an extreme example, and for any physicist listening, I wouldn't suggest going to a bar with Dick, because it would be a very traumatic experience. but certainly he did embody that spirit, which is, like you say, you know, who says I can't do this? And sometimes these people fail. I mean, they fail gloriously, but when they succeed, they do incredible things. And all of them, I also found they all had this burning ambition to make the world better. That was what guided them. They were bigger than them. They wanted to be involved with something bigger than themselves. And I think that also drove them as well. They weren't doing it for themselves. They were doing it for some kind of higher purpose. And some of them were called by a religious thinking. Other than were called just by a desire to just be inquisitive and learn more about science. Some of them were atheists, but very, you know, humanitarian. They came from all sorts of perspectives, sort of intellectually and spiritually, but they all believed in making the world better, being part of something bigger than themselves, and also not waiting for permission to do the right thing. That's the other thing that struck me about all of them. They were all, you know what, I don't need the government's permission or, you know, my institution's permission to go and think about this problem and try and solve it for other people, which, again, I found very inspiring.
Let's talk with a caller here. We have someone on a cell phone here in our area on our line 4. We'll go there. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. The phone connection notwithstanding, very, very provocative. I enjoyed the conversation. I wanted to throw a couple of things out there maybe for your guest to comment on. I'm in my mid-50s, and the realization comes at some point, I think, that it is going to be a very, very different life that your children are going to have than the one you had. And I think that's probably generational and perhaps just a matter of course. What I'm experiencing now is the implementation of new technologies is very rapid. It's very fast. Thinking back 20, 25 years ago, trying to talk to your children, you know, before we had cell phones and the internet, and of course they look at you like you have three heads. But the thing that I'm trying to come to terms with for the future, certainly not within my lifetime, but is the number of just the sheer number of people on this planet and how that would impact the progress of a positive future, just the sheer number of mouths to feed. And then also, I think the ongoing dilemma is the distribution of wealth, which is probably the genesis of most conflicts in this world. And I think we need to come to terms with those two things, just as factors, that is going to impact any positive thoughts we might have of the future. And I'll go ahead and ring off if you want to comment.
Okay. This, you know, it's interesting because maybe about a week or so ago, not too long ago, I talked with the author who had written a book where he had spent a lot of time talking with scientists who are working on the issue of human life extension. Aubrey de Grey, in fact, appears as a prominent character in his book.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that in that conversation, the people who were calling in and reacting to it, I think ultimately we didn't talk very much about the science. The thing that people went right to were the demographic questions raised, and the very first thing that the caller talks about, that was it. I think that people are still very much concerned with this idea of global population and the burden that these people put, again, in terms of resource consumption and waste production, the burden that they put on the planet.
Yeah, and it's a very good point. It's something I covered in the book. And again, you know, what I'm not saying here that the future is going to be better. I'm saying it could be, and so we have choices. But one of the things I found heartening about population was I also had this worry, you know, that you know we just cannot carry on like this. We've got too many people being born. It's a very popular fear. What was heartening to find out was that the fertility rate of the world is actually dropping. So worldwide, just go back one step. To keep the population stable, every woman on average needs to have 2.1 children. That's the statistical number. And actually, if you look at most of the developed countries in the world, none of them are replacing their population, including the United States, Canada, China, every single country in Europe, Singapore, Thailand. I mean, I could go on. It's a very, very long list. And actually, worldwide, the fertility rate has dropped from about 4.6 in the 1950s to about 2.5 in 2000. And by about 2050, the UN reckons we'll hit that 2.1 figure the world over, which means the population will stabilize at about 9 billion. And a lot of that is to do with countries becoming more prosperous, a lot more people moving to cities, and there's all sorts of downward pressures on the number of children you have, which I talk about in the book. So the good news is that it's not like the rate of population is growing at an ever-increasing rate. It's actually slowing down, and all the best guess is now that we'll stabilize around about 9 billion. In fact, some economists are now worried about that because they think it will start to drop off the other side, and they believe that economic growth is entirely linked to population growth. I mean, I disagree with them, but it's interesting to hear that some people are now worried about the population falling. So that's the first bit of good news. The second bit of good news is that, well, can we actually feed 9 billion people? And the answer is yes, we can, and we've managed to feed. Actually, there's more food per capita on the planet now than there's ever been. But it comes to your second point from your caller, which is about distribution of resources and distribution of wealth. Where we have had shocking malnutrition, like someplace in Africa, that's not because we haven't produced enough food. It's because we haven't distributed it or the means of production equitably. But that is a problem that can be solved, distribution. It's not an absolute limit where we simply don't have enough food. We have enough food. We need to distribute it better. And some of the innovations I looked at in agriculture and also in nanotechnology are doing a lot to address that balance. So, yes, we the population stabilized. Yes, we can feed 9 billion. I'm not saying that will happen, but some of the options I talk about in my book, again, if we apply ourselves with thought and diligence and with good conscience, then we can reach that stage. The same with, we talked about energy earlier, if we manage to shift over from fossil fuels to more solar, to more renewables, to bacterial fuels, again, we have more than enough resources to support a population of 9 billion. So it may not happen. I think the worries that your caller raises are extremely pertinent. What I'm trying to do is say, hey, here's the options for how we deal with it, because we are going to have 9 billion people, so we better start thinking about how to make that life prosperous for as many people as possible. Mm.
Well, that gets to the other part of the caller's question, and maybe it's a different kind of conversation, but that I'm sure that many people would say, yes, it would appear that in many ways technology offers the opportunity for improving of the way that we live, living longer, living better, and yet the question is, and will everyone have access to those technologies?
Yeah. Yeah, and there's this whole issue about the distribution of wealth, the wealthy are getting wealthier and the poor are getting poorer. And so I suppose you have to look at what your metrics are, what's important. So I think probably the two of the most important metrics are health, how long you live and how healthily, and how many calories you eat. Those are probably the really important metrics if you want to compare people worldwide. And again, if you look at the figures, what's really interesting is that the gap between rich and poor in terms of life expectancy and length of a healthy life is shrinking rapidly. You can be as rich and rich as you like, but it's not going to give you any as many extra long years of life and healthy life than a poor person would get for actually a very small investment in social care and healthcare. So worldwide, you're seeing this massive decrease between the rich and poor in terms of their life expectancy and also in terms of the number of calories they consume. Now, that doesn't deal with the inequalities of somebody being massively rich, but it does mean that, you know, if you only have to go back 100, 150 years, you know, on average a poor person would live, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, shorter than a rich person. That's not the case anymore. We still have inequalities of wealth, but at least we are having less inequalities of health. One of the things that does happen as we have the technologies that give us slightly more abundance, particularly nanotechnology, which is going to start making things cheaper in the way that computing technology has made the processing of information cheaper, then we'll start to see this area where we have to redefine what wealth is. I mean, how, you know, if we live in a world of abundance, what does it mean to be wealthy? I mean, I look at myself now. I live probably more wealthily and with more opportunity and with more healthcare than a king would have 300 years ago. And I live a fairly modest lifestyle in a small apartment in London. But yet the opportunities available to me and technology has given me actually an incredible lifestyle. So am I wealthy? Well, you ask somebody, you know, even 50 years ago or 100 years ago, they would probably think I was incredibly wealthy. So again, I think we have to nuance our discussion as we think about the future, about what it means to be wealthy. And I think most of all, what it means to be wealthy is to have a long, healthy life, to be able to have enough resources on your plate, and to be happy. And we again, I'm not saying that will happen for everybody, but we have the technologies, and I think we have the will and the know-how and the moral direction to get there.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour is Mark Stevenson. He's a writer, has been a writer and comedian both, does a lot of speaking and consulting on things like institutional motivation. He has worked in the areas of prime number cryptography and computer-aided systems engineering. He is the co-founder and director of the cultural learning agency Flow Associates and also the science communication agency ReAgency. He lives in London. And some of the ideas here that we're talking about, you will find in his book, An Optimist's Tour of the Future. The subtitle is One Curious Man Sets Out to Answer What's Next. Avery is the publisher. Questions, certainly welcome. We welcome people into the conversation. You can do that very easily by calling us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's another caller, someone in Effingham, line one. Hello.
Yes. Hello. My first question for you, David. You use two terms. And your guest used one as well, utopia. And then you, David, said, was it dystopia?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I wanted to be sure about that. That's a new word for me. But
Essentially, that means the opposite. You know, a utopia is something that's really good, and dystopia is something that's really bad. So they're the companion. Well, they're the two sides of the coin.
Yes. Well, I assumed that, but I wanted to be sure. That's why I asked.
Yes.
But my question for your guest is the paradigm by which we exist is known worldwide as capitalism. And I am an anti-capitalist person because all I have to do is look at the results of what has happened and how it has discombobulated the whole of life on this earth. And how it continues to do that, and what then can be done to change that, to make society a more equitable place, and to ensure that we not only have a life, but we have a decent life. And thus far in this world, if I'm understanding the stats right, there is probably 90% of the 7 billion people on Earth now who have nothing, who exist on a dollar a day in some places, and still have to conform to the capitalist paradigm in order. But the only other thing, and I'll end with this, is a young man on one of the, I think it was Celeste program years ago, who equated money and air. And if you can't live without air, and you cannot live without money. I'll ring off, and thank you very much.
Well, I think those are absolutely brilliant points, and I talk about capitalism in the book. One of the things that you realize that capitalism is entirely based on the idea of scarcity. So resources are scarce, and that's why we pay a premium for them, and that means the rich can get more of them and the poor get less of them. What's really interesting about technology is you start to see that people have access to resources they didn't have previously. I use myself as an example. If I compare my life now to what my parents' life was like, I actually have a lot more access to technology and to resources. What's really interesting is that you're starting to see capitalism shift and change shape. It's not really what it was like a few years ago. Take a company like Facebook. Okay, this is now an absolutely massive company generating huge amounts of wealth, okay, for its shareholders. But it got started with almost no money. The average startup of a high-tech startup in Singapore now is just $50,000, which is almost nothing for a high-tech startup. So you're starting to see the ability of people who don't come from money to do incredible things because of the technology the power that technology offers them. So I think we do have a battle with capitalism. I think capitalism is to a certain extent a function of scarcity. As scarcity gets less and less, as we learn to harness more of this energy, as we start to use technologies like nanotechnology to bring the cost of many things down. And that is coming now. There are some very good examples of that. Water filters, for instance, are coming down massively in price, which means that nanotechnology has taken the specter of water wars pretty much off the table. It's not widely known yet, but desalination is now going to be much, much cheaper because of these membranes. And you're going to start to see that sort of stuff happening. Also, if you look at what's happening in developing countries now, you're starting to see them really getting off the ground. I'm actually involved in a project in Africa and Asia now where we're working with 30 million people using networks to help them get out of that trap of poverty and to give them direct access to knowledge and resources. And when you give people access to knowledge, particularly intellectual resources, and you emancipate women, which is what is generally happening across the developing world now, you see within a generation or two a massive increase in the quality of life. So your caller is absolutely right. We do need to really think about the values that are based in capitalism and how we challenge them. I would argue that technology and the wise use of it is one of the things that starts to undermine some of the more pernicious elements of capitalism. But I am with him. I think everybody should be in that game because certainly we need a more equitable society. And I hope I put some of those options on the table in the book, which will hopefully encourage more people to go, hey, things could be better.
All right. Again, questions welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk a little bit more about the science of life extension, which I said again recently. We did an entire program on that, and it was looking at the fact that one thing you have to say is that there has been a pretty dramatic extension in human life, roughly speaking, over the last 100 years. And that then, though, there are scientists who are now trying to understand the mechanisms of aging, trying to understand what we can do about the diseases that tend to kill people, and the simple fact that body parts wear out, and that there are indeed scientists who talk seriously about people perhaps living hundreds of years, if not more. Mm-hmm. And again, I said, you know, what happened on this last conversation we had about this was people went right to the demographic question and said, well, we're going to have a problem here if everybody lives to be 1,000. Setting that aside, though, and I'm interested in maybe having you talk a little bit more about the science part of this and whether it is, in fact, realistic to think about even somebody living, let's say, to 200, much less, you know, much less 1,000.
Yeah, I think it is realistic to start thinking about that. And so some examples of the science that I saw, there are now people walking around America with replacement organs that have been grown for them from their own stem cells in the laboratory. So people have actually got brand new replacement, you know, body parts. And also I saw talk about a man called Robert Ab Eckenstam, who lost his hand to cancer. He's had it replaced with a robotic hand that's controlled by his thoughts, and it returns to him a sense of touch. So all of a sudden, you are seeing this massive leap forward in medicine. What's happening with the genomics revolution, where actually we can start to help people not get ill in the first place by understanding how their genetic code interacts with their environment, so that they avoid some illnesses that might have befallen them before. And also there's an avalanche of new drugs coming based on that genomic medicine, because a lot of drugs now we can't use because they might be fatal, say, for 1% of the population. But if everybody has their genome sequence, we can go, you're the 1% that can't have it. But that does mean I can now give this drug to the 99% of people that it will save or will help. So you are starting to see a revolution in medicine where we're likely to get ill less. The medicine will become cheaper and become preventative, where when we do have things that go wrong, we can replace them either using sort of more hardware technology or more software, like, as I say, replacement body parts. So that sort of stuff is coming, and I think it's really important that we do have this debate about, well, what do we do when that becomes reality? Because the thing is, everybody personally starts to think, well, that's great. You know, maybe when I'm, you know, getting into my later years and, you know, my pancreas is giving me trouble or my liver is giving me trouble, well, wouldn't it be great if I could have a spare put in? And so personally, people will say, yes, I think it's a good idea. Or if it's one of their loved ones, you know, if you say, would you like us to cure your loved one of cancer by giving them a new liver, they'll go, of course. But then you start to bring in with that the same question, which is, well, actually, that same technology is now allowing them to live a lot longer. So where do we go with this? And again, that's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, because I want people to have that debate and to think about it carefully. So you know, if we all start living to 200 or 1,000, what do we do? Well, do we go to other planets and colonize them? Do we have less children? I mean, the birth rate is dropping anyway. So by 2050, it might be that people living a bit longer isn't such a problem because we're not having children as much as we used to. But there is no easy answer to this question, and that's another reason I wanted to write the book, to say, but it is a question, and we as a society need to address it. I don't think you're going to stop the advance of knowledge and technology, because those times are over now, especially with increasing autonomy of the individual and the access to knowledge via the internet. So the question is, how do we guide that in a positive, moral way? And that's another sort of reason behind me writing the book. Yeah. So the question is open, and it needs to be engaged with, and I'm glad you raised it.
Well, and that I think that points to a problem I think sometimes we have with new technologies, is that generally speaking, we're fairly enthusiastic about adopting them. And not quite so good at looking ahead and asking the question, what are the consequences if we do adopt these technologies? And the problem we have now is that the pace of technology is so fast, it really doesn't give us very much time to ask that what-if question.
Yeah, I think that's again, absolutely a really spot-on observation. It's one of the things I struggled with in the book, just having this sort of massive information hitting me about this rapid innovation we see in technology now. And one of the things I came to realize was that I had to really change my way of thinking about the future. I've grown up in an industrial capitalist society. My education was basically looked like a factory. I went through a school. They gave me a bunch of skills. They spat me out the other end. I think the way we think about the future has to change. We have to realize that change is the norm, not the exception. We have to be able to think about change quite quickly and react to it quite quickly. And human beings can do that. There are lots of examples of humans that do that. But our education system hasn't really taught us, en masse to do it. I mean, look at what's happening with the internet, for instance. There's this massive information coming at us. And what we used to do was we let other people filter it for us. We'd let newspapers or publishers or politicians filter it for us. Now, when everybody's got access to it, we're beginning to see just how bad a job they've been doing. But also, now we have to be able to filter. We have to have those skills to think critically about all information and work out whether it's politically biased or where it's coming from. And these are skills that have not really been championed in our schooling system. I certainly didn't get them in my schooling system. So again, one of the things I talk about towards the end of the book is how our minds need to change to embrace the future, and how we must be teaching our children critical thinking skills and the ability to have basically their minds work at the same time constant as what's happening in the speed of innovation. That's not impossible. It's not difficult. It's just a new way of thinking about the future that's different from the old, and therefore people find it scary. I absolutely agree with you. We need to change our minds to meet the future.
Let's talk with another caller, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello. I find your focus on technology to be somewhat limiting. It seems to me the broader spectrum of science is more important than simply the technologies. And I worry about this. I think it is dependent upon education, and at least in this country, and it seems to me in your country, there is somewhat of a disinclination to adequately fund education and to too narrowly define what education is. It seems to me it must always be broader than vocational.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you. That's a really brilliant point. And one of the reasons that I run a learning consultancy is because I'm very concerned about this point myself. What we have is an education system that looks very much like a factory. It's interesting that we all graduate the same year, regardless of our skills, as if the most important thing we have in common is our year of manufacture, for instance. So I think what we need to do is not teach people so much particular bits of knowledge, but teach them ways of thinking. So when you talked about science there, that's particularly important because the scientific method gives you a very useful way of looking at the world, seeking out other prejudices and your own, and basing your reactions on evidence. And I think that certainly we need to encourage people to have those critical thinking skills. Our education system needs to change to do it. I talk about that towards the back end of the book. So again, I agree with you. I think our current education system isn't really helping a huge amount there, but it could do. It could change. And also we can talk about how we educate our children at home and what we say to them. A really good example for me was a man called Isidore Rabbi. He's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. And he was asked, why did you become a scientist? And he said, my mother made me a scientist without her realizing it, because when I came home from school every day, she didn't ask me what I learned. She asked me if I asked a good question that day. I think that's something that every parent can do to their child straight away. And already, just with that one simple thing, you'll begin to embody in them a kind of a questing disposition that allows them to think critically about the world. So I completely agree with your point, and it's something I discuss in the book.
In this country, I think more than in Europe, there's also an antagonism toward science and intellectualism in general.
Yeah,
I find very dangerous. It's something like, I think the survey that was done recently, between 60% and 70% of Americans didn't believe in global warming.
Yeah. Well, first thing I would say is you have to look at all those surveys in broad, in the round, because there's a lot of different surveys, and I looked at a number, and the conclusion I came to was about 40% of Americans are doubtful about global warming, so it's not quite as high as 70 or 80. And it depends on different states. You'll find that the coasts are generally more believing in the climate change threat, and the states in the middle of the country are less so. But this antagonism towards the scientific method, I think, is absolutely right. I think you've hit a nail on the head there. And I think one of the reasons that you tend to get this sort of anti-intellectual counterpoint is usually at the times of most change, because when things are moving rapidly, it's a very natural reaction for people to go, hang on, this isn't what God ordered, this isn't what I ordered, this is moving too fast, I need something to hold on to. And so people tend to hold on to, perhaps an outdated religious belief or an outdated way of thinking that comforted them a few years ago. And that's why I think the point you raised earlier about education is so important, because the one thing I'm very clear about is that it's very difficult to hold on to something essentially human, for want of a better word, by trying to fight against the thing that humans do best, which is evolve through culture and technology. Whether we like it or not, that's what we do as a species. So I think your worry is very well founded. Part of my sort of attack on that, or trying to deal with that, is to write the book and to run a learning consultancy. I think if you feel the same, then it's time to roll up your sleeves and challenge it wherever you can, but also understand why people feel that way. I think it's perfectly natural at times of big change to feel scared and to hold on to something that perhaps isn't going to help you so much.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let me go to a different area and move from talking about wetware to hardware. Talk about computers a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We now, certainly now, we have machines that are capable of performing an enormous number of calculations and doing that very fast.
Yeah.
And what has happened over time is that the number of calculations they can handle and the speed has continued to increase, and we have made the package smaller and smaller, so smaller and smaller devices being able to do this, and there, I'm sure there are still scientists who say that there is still possibility of even both making smaller packages and making faster processing. Now, at the same time, though, what we have, these are machines that have this enormous calculating ability, but they can't think.
Yeah.
And I think that scientists had expected by this point, that they really would have cracked the artificial intelligence problem and would have a machine that could think in the way that humans can think. And it seems at this point that that's maybe now still some way off, if ever. Why has that been such a difficult thing?
Well, it's a really good point you raise there, and the point about processing power is very well made. I mean, it's increased a billionfold, in the last 20 years. There's more processing power in your mobile phone than there was in the entire Apollo space mission. The reason is that artificial intelligence, Steven Pinker makes this point very well. He said, when it comes to artificial intelligence, we've discovered that the easy things are difficult and the difficult things are easy. So it's relatively easy to get a computer to beat a grandmaster like Garry Kasparov at chess. Mm-hmm. It's a very logical way of running through possibilities. But that same computer would absolutely have no clue as how to make it across a room without bumping into something or go and get you a cup of tea or recognize a face. So what we found is that this number-crunching ability is all very well, but you'll find that AI tends to succeed where they have a very constrained set of options. You know, you play chess, and that's all you do. Or, you know, you program the gates at airports, and that's all you do. Or you're a gaming brain, but that's all you do. What is very difficult is linking all of those different experiences, those different ways that we process information, and making them cogent so it becomes some kind of general experiential machine. So what you're seeing in robotics and artificial intelligence now is people really trying to build brains from the bottom up. Rather than trying to build an intelligent brain, as it were, from the get-go, they're building very simple things that sense and react to the environment, and then seeing if over a period they can start to learn in the way that a child learns. In fact, Alan Turing, who is regarded as probably the father of computing, he wrote a very interesting essay back in the 1950s where he said, you know, I propose to answer the question, can machines think? And he came to the conclusion it would be better to build a machine that looks more like a child's brain than educate it, than try and build a fully functioning adult brain. And I think people are now beginning to realize that. I went to see some very interesting research at MIT in Boston and at Cornell University as well, where people are starting to get some very impressive results by thinking a bit more in the way that we might think about children rather than think about computers.
Hmm. So there are people who think also that it's possible to improve the human-computer interface in ways that we now see in science fiction, where you have machines that can understand human speech, that you can talk to, tell it what you want. It can say, ask questions and say, now, is this what you want? You know, that kind of interaction. And possibly even get to the idea of having some kind of physical link between person and machine.
Yeah, I mean, again, you are starting to see some impressive results now. If you look at what happened with Watson on Jeopardy, you know, that was a machine that was able to understand quite a complex piece of natural language in a conversational style, and also understand the context of it to know, you know, whether cookie meant biscuit or was referring to the cookie monster in Sesame Street, or whether it was somebody's name, a dog's name. So be able to understand that context. The idea of whether we can interface with our machines is one that's very fraught, I think. I don't think it's conclusively been proved at all at the moment that we can link silicon with our neurons in any way that makes massive, massive sense. However, I talked about that man earlier who has a hand that is controlled by his thought processes, by linking that hand, this artificial hand, into his nerve endings. So we are beginning to see the beginnings of that. The more general point about AI is, as you say, that they can crunch through numbers, but they can't derive meaning, and that's one of the things I discuss in the book. I think it's a very interesting area to watch. I'm going to be watching it with a lot of diligence over the coming years, and I think everybody else should. And again, another reason for writing the book is, you know, you should keep an eye on this, because what happens if you suddenly can help a brain damaged patient by implanting some technology into their skull? Is that a good idea? Is it a bad idea? Where does that lead us? These are questions that we need to be answering.
All right. Another caller here in line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Along the lines of what you're talking about right now, I was wondering about your guest's thoughts on the singularity. Do you think that's going to happen where computers become smarter than people or whatnot? And I'd love to hear your answer off the air.
Fantastic. The singularity. For any of your listeners that don't know, the singularity is an event or a moment in time that's been postulated by a man called Ray Kurzweil. He's perhaps America's most famous futurist and inventor. I've met him a number of times. And he believes that by 2050, technology will be advancing at such a rate, particularly artificial intelligence, that the computers will become smarter than we are. And what will happen at that point is we will merge with our machines, and we will move on to what he calls a post-human state, where humans and technology merge. And he calls it the singularity because after that point, all bets are off. It's a completely singular event, and we can't predict what happens beyond that point. And he reckons that will happen sometime in 2050. Now, again, the singularity is one of those arguments I cover in the book because I think it's important to have those questions raised and to think about. And, you know, it can be quite fun and raise very, very entertaining. The thing I think myself about the singularity is that all technology is social, technical. Regardless of how fast technology advances, it still requires society to think about what to do with it and how to interact with it. And society is a big brake on a lot of technology. And in fact, our governments sometimes are too much of a brake on it because they slow things down. So we have a choice. about where we go with our technology. I don't agree with Ray that we don't. I think we do have a choice. I think there are various other options. The singularity is one, and it needs to be discussed as an idea. But, you know, there are other options where, you know, we don't merge with our machines, but we do end up, you know, being friends with them. Mm. And there are other options where people say, you know, machines are just not built in the right way to ever reach a level of consciousness. It's just the wrong stuff. You'll never get a conscious machine out of silicon. So I think the singularity is a brilliant argument. I think it should be engaged with, because in engaging with it, we start to think more carefully about some of the important questions that are facing it.
Yeah. Well, we're unfortunately coming down to a point. We have about 2 minutes left. Oh. And with opening up here an interesting area, myself, I think that the kinds of things Kurzweil talks about raises some interesting questions, at least in this respect. I think about human evolution.
Yeah.
And about the idea that really, if you look at the point where modern humans evolved, some, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, I guess, the truth is that we haven't changed very much since. But what the kinds of things that he says opens the question, first of all, is further really profound human evolution possible, and will technology be the agent of that evolution?
Yeah, I think that's something I don't disagree with, Ray, and I think it's very hard to disagree. If you look at us, we haven't changed physically very much for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, but our society has changed massively. You know, with no disrespect to our primate ancestors and cousins, you know, they didn't build cities. They didn't have radio programs like this to have deep philosophical questions about the singularity. That is what human beings do. We evolve through technology, but we also evolve through culture, through exchanging our ideas, which is something that again, you know, different tribes of primates don't do, but we do. And that is something that we need to embrace and steer in a good direction.
Anything I'm sure that you've in the course of doing this exercise, traveling around, talking to all those people, you had a lot of amazing experiences and saw a lot of stuff that just really blew your mind. Is there anything, though, that really stands out as just being one of the most mind-blowing things that you saw?
I think the thing that that really kind of blew my mind the most was the idea that you could create a carbon-neutral petrol station by taking carbon out of the sky. I saw a man who's built a machine that can do that efficiently, and then feeding that carbon into a bacteria that will create gasoline. So basically, a one-stop carbon-neutral answer to both the energy crisis, and climate change, almost to a certain extent. So it was the combination of technologies and how they can be made to work together to do incredible things that I suppose really blew me away.
And did you the sort of optimistic turn that the work has? Is that something that you began with, or is it something that you really did acquire?
No, not at all. And in fact, I'm a little bit worried about the title of the book, because I think it makes it sound like I did start out with that, and then I'm trying to sell that to the reader. And actually, I started out just writing a book called A World Tour of the Future, but having come back, I was so amazed by all these things I'd seen that I was beginning to feel, actually, no, we can solve these problems. We do have the tools, and we do have the will to be able to do it, and that's actually made me change the title of the book. So really, it's a tour of the scientific horizon, and it says at the end, you know what, if we direct ourselves properly, if we manage our scientific and technological evolution in a way that everybody gets involved with, then we can have a future that's a lot better than the one that's being sold to us. So no, I became convinced that we can have an optimistic future if we all choose to engage with it in the right way.
Well, we're going to have to stop. My apologies here. In fact, I just got an email question. I'm sorry I can't get it in because we've got to end. Maybe we can continue to talk about some of these things in future shows with future guests, but for right now, we'll have to say thanks to our guest, Mark Stevenson. And if you'd like to read his book, the title is An Optimist's Tour of the Future, One Curious Man Sets Out to Answer What's Next. Avery is the publisher on the book. And Mr. Stevenson, thanks very much.
Well, thank you for having me, David. You're a brilliant question, a very intelligent. And I will just say, if any of your listeners do have questions, they can email me at my website, and I'll more than happily answer them.
That's great. Well, thank you again.
Thank you.